Welcome to the Pint and Click podcast, everyone. My name's Dave. I'm here with Jamie and Tony, and we are three librarians and assistants from the Des Plaines Public Library. And we're here to talk about books and games and movies and music and anything that happens to strike our fancy in the past couple of weeks. Today, we're going to start with Jamie. Jamie, what do you like to talk about today?
I'm going to talk about the show Steven Universe, which is a cartoon put out by Cartoon Network. And my sisters have been obsessed with this show for a long time and have been trying to get me to watch it. So I finally started watching it, and they're 10-minute episodes, so I've been able to plow through them. I'm on episode 51 right now, and it's about a 10-year-old really goofy boy named Steven Universe, obviously, and his life with the three crystal gems, who are these humanoid kind of alien women that he lives with, and their names are Garnet, Amethyst, and Pearl. They each have a gem in one part of their body, and that's where their power comes from, and that's really who they are. Their forms are just kind of like their outer appearance. They're really these gems.
All right.
And the show goes back and forth between talking about, you know, Steven's struggles as he tries to accept who he is, because he, unlike the crystal gems, is also part human. His mother was Rose Quartz, who was the leader of the other crystal gems, but when she gave birth to Steven, she gave up her own human form so that he could live. And his father owns a car wash, and he has a huge farmer's tan, and he's a really goofy, like, ex-rocker dude. And over the course of the show, Steven's trying to be able to channel his powers and figure out how the human side of him and the gem side of him work together, and they all have to save the world.
All right.
Great. So what's an example of one of the threats or adversaries that they have to face?
Well, at the beginning, each threat is kind of disparate, and they don't seem to be working together. Like, one is this evil pufferfish that is attempting to attack their town of Beach City, which is a city on the coast, a made-up city. Mm-hmm. And at the beginning, it was harder for me to get into it. It's definitely a slow burn because I didn't see the greater threat altogether. But later, as the show goes on, you get to see that all of these monsters are part of this larger series of beings that are controlled by other gems from Homeworld, which is where the crystal gems are originally from. And we get this backstory and realize that the crystal gems are the only ones who wanted to save Earth. The other gems wanted to destroy the planet. They didn't care about the planet. And so the crystal gems are kind of the only ones who wanted to save the planet. And there was these huge wars back in the day. And so all these things are kind of remnants that are left over from the old wars and from this other Homeworld. And again, the pieces are only starting to come together because I'm not even at the end of the first season yet. But definitely it got more and more engaging as the show went on. And it's so goofy is why I love it. There's so much about, like, donuts and his friends at the donut store. And, like, he plays his ukulele a lot and sings some songs. There's a lot of singing on the show. Nice. It's very goofy, but it's also very poignant. The dynamics between the characters are really strong. And this was Cartoon Network's first show that was put out by a woman whose name is Rebecca Sugar. And she developed the story while she was working on the show Adventure Time. Cool. So it came out in 2013. And it's been nominated for an Emmy.
Awesome. Yeah. Is it meant for kids? Is it meant for adults? Does it cross that line easily?
I would definitely say it crossed that line. When I was on vacation, my six-year-old cousin was so engaged with it and watching it really rapt. And my fiance, who's a 32-year-old teacher, also was really engaged with it. So I think it's one where if you're a little kid, you can still enjoy it. But if you're older, you can definitely engage with it on a different level because there's a lot of different, like, social justice issues that they take up. Gay rights is an issue that is definitely threaded through there. So I think it is appealing for different ages, but definitely the level of understanding or your understanding of, like, the metaphor in the show is definitely different depending on age.
I'm not sure if this is going to be easy to answer, but, like, the animation style, like, can you say anything about that? If it's remarkable in any particular ways?
It's pretty similar to Adventure Time, I would say. It's very colorful. Like, the colors are really bright and vivid. The line drawings are very simple. Like, there's no shading or anything like that. It's pretty bubbly and cartoonish.
Cartoonish. Like, Adventure Time is really almost, it takes these abstract, funny ideas and just plays with them, like the sizes of their eyes and faces and weird things like that. So
they do star eyes when they're really excited. Like, their eyes get really huge and have stars in them and things like that. So,
awesome.
Yeah.
That sounds like it'd be a lot of fun.
Like I said, it's a slow burn, so you have to give it maybe 12 episodes, which sounds like a lot, but it's only 2 hours before deciding what you think about it. But I really enjoyed it.
Does it have kind of the tone of Adventure Time, where it's a little bit random, unfocused, a little wild?
I would say in some ways, yes. There's a definite level of like silliness to the show, but I think it's very, especially as the show gets later on in the series, it has a definite trajectory towards where it's going. The episodes all kind of start marching towards this idea of the crystal gems versus these other gems. So it definitely has like a huge, larger arc and a definite nemesis, I think. So as it reaches like that later level, kind of the silliness or the randomness kind of fades away more.
Sure.
Where it's still funny, but the humor definitely all serves this greater story arc.
I was just looking at the cast. I love cartoons. I love Cartoon Network, Adult Swim cartoons and things like that. And I don't recognize a lot of the cast. That was kind of a surprise to me. Do you find the cast engaging? Are they good at playing their characters?
Yes, definitely. The only one whose voice I had recognized is the one who plays Garnet, one of the Crystal Gems. She is the singer. I can't remember her name right now, but she sang with Kanye on American Boy.
Okay.
So she's the only one that I had recognized in any capacity. But I think that the cast does a really great job of each gem is really distinct and has their own personality, but is each accessible to both kids and also to adults, where it doesn't seem like anything is necessarily like a trope, really, or too much of a caricature. I mean, it's a cartoon,
sure.
But each character definitely has depth and pretty detailed background and story arcs and character arcs where we get to see their background and histories and what they've had to deal with over the millennia that they've been alive since they're aliens.
Oh, all right.
have changed them. And I think there's a lot of nuance that isn't necessarily there for shows that are always aimed at 10-year-olds. So,
yeah.
Well, I'm suddenly fascinated by that. Is it on Netflix? Is it on Hulu? Or
no, it's
streaming
only on,
from the website?
It's only on Cartoon Network or, you know, available on the internet.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
All right. And that is Steven Universe, 10-minute, and you say you're at 51 episodes.
Yeah.
Do you know how many seasons there are?
It started in 2013.
Mm-hmm. Two, maybe
three. So
that'd
be like the fourth one right now. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So. Awesome. Yeah. So let's go to Tony next. Tony, what are you going to talk about today?
Yeah, so I'm talking about a board game, Galaxy Trucker, a board game by, I guess, Czech Games. The game maker is Vlada Chivatl. So in Galaxy Trucker, you know, you play between 2 to 4 players, and each player commands a ship. But the thing about their ship, your ship starts with a blank board, and you have to take all of these face-down tiles that are pieces for the ship, and you have to construct the ship in a short period of time and then navigate the perils of space.
Mm-hmm.
So you're going around a board. You have a finite amount of time to get your ship kind of looking how you want it to look, but then there are kind of rules on how you can build the ship. So certain things can only connect in certain ways. And this is a very visual, of course, game. Like each of these tiles has visual cues to tell you what type of part it is, you know, whether it's a laser beam or a thruster or whether it has conduits that can fit one way or the other. Sounds very complex. It does take a while to explain. So it's definitely like that type of kind of complex board game.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really rewarding, too, because it really plays on that feeling of like kind of being in a space opera or being in a Star Trek episode, because you're like flying around space with these different random encounters, whether it's you know, aliens or raiders or asteroid fields or something like that. So like it can be a very punishing game, and you know, you think you have something really cool in that the ship you just spent, you know, the last 5 minutes building, but it gets like torn apart and torn to shreds by the perils of space.
Sure.
So it's a really neat journey for the players involved. It's kind of hard to like describe to you like what it's like to make a ship from nothing, but it's like, you know, I guess if you had a visual aid, it might be helpful.
So I've played Galaxy Trucker. It's been a while, but collecting the pieces for the ship and putting them together is almost like a board game version of Tetris. You've got a big pile of tiles that are face down, so you don't know what you're getting, and you grab it, look at it, and then you got to figure out how to insert it into your ship. Should it go on the left side? Should it go on the right side? It can attach here, but you know, maybe I want a laser on the other side. I've got a laser on the left side already. And so you've got 5 minutes to just grab tiles and do it. So you want to do it fast. You want to get as many tiles as you can get, as big a ship as you can get. But you're restrained, and you're trying to plan for events that you don't know what's coming. And so it's kind of a frantic, exciting board game. And everyone's doing this at the same time. You're not taking turns. You're not one tile at a time.
Is this cooperative? You're all working on the same ship, or do you each have your own?
No, it's competitive.
Each have your own ship.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's kind of just like everyone's making a mad grab for the center to try to get their tiles, and you want more tiles than your friends because you want to win the game, and you want to have a better ship than they do.
Yeah, and for that reason, it's a little anxiety-inducing, too. Mm-hmm. So if you have a low threshold for anxiety, then when that clock is ticking, you're like, oh, no, you know, like, what if I put down the piece I needed or something like that? So it definitely favors people who have played it, like, once or twice. But I think, like, you know, if you're jumping into it new or a group of people that are new to the game, it's a ton of fun.
Galaxy Trucker is a board game. It's not found at your average store. You might have to go online to buy it. You might have to go to a local game store to buy it. I played it at a friend's house many years ago, so it's been out for a long time.
Yeah, and I guess the other thing worth noting is it's also an app now on iOS. You can get it for $5 and try it. Yeah, so, I mean, that's way cheaper, and you can still, I think, play multiplayer with people. So,
yeah, I think the board game is like $60 if you can get a $5 app.
Yeah.
For your iPad. You know, there's no cleanup afterwards on the tiles.
Yeah.
You don't have to put them back in the box.
Or even, like, think about how the rules work, because it'll probably work for you. So,
sure.
Yeah. So I think it's on an iPad.
Yeah. One of the reasons I bought my iPad was just because of ports of board games that weren't on Android. I have an Android phone. I had an Android tablet, and all these board games were just coming out for iOS. Ticket to Ride, Tigris and Euphrates just came out, and these are great games, but I had to have an iPad, so like that's why I spent the money on an iPad, was more or less for these $5 board games. So I'm kind of saving money and losing money at the same time in that respect, that I had to buy the iPad, but the games are only $5.
Yeah.
How do you find that experience is compared with playing the actual board game?
I would prefer the board game if you have the time and the occasion and the friends. If you're like, I have a Saturday, I have nothing to do, my friends are going to come over, let's play a real board game. Whereas the iPad is a lot more isolated. Mm-hmm. I'm just going to sit by myself and play this game quietly, sitting on the couch in the corner of my living room. Not nearly as much fun. Not social. Even though it's competitive, you can play against people online, it's still not social. Mm-hmm. So I would prefer the board game in every aspect other than convenience. The iPad versions are convenient and cheap. They're convenient and cheap. That's two things, I suppose. Where you can play whenever you want. You can play if no one else wants to play your favorite game. Everyone wants to play a different game. And you're like, well, I still want to play Galaxy Trucker. You can play it whenever you want on the iPad. And that's handy. But it doesn't compare, in my opinion.
And then the other thing I just wanted to note, if you're listening to the Pint and Click podcast, you probably already know that we do a tabletop night. So just keep an eye out on the library media for the tabletop games night at Tap House Grill.
Wildly popular, I might add. I'm always impressed when I hear the numbers on how many people show up. And are you overflowing your private room yet? I think so.
I think this time we're probably going to overflow it in some respect and have to get another table outside.
Yeah, we have a waiting list right now.
Oh, so, my goodness.
Yeah, we have five people on the waiting list. So I hope everyone shows up that RSVP'd so we don't have to turn people away.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, thanks, Tony. Let's move on to me. I'm going to talk about a book. It is Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People. Now, it's a little funny to talk about because a lot of the things we talk about on the podcast are cutting edge books that may be a little bit under the radar, movies that just came out. I'm going to talk about a book from 1936, one of the best-selling books of all time. How to Win Friends and Influence People. It's been recommended to me by several friends throughout my life, and I'm always like, I don't know. It sounds like it's going to be very selfish to read a book like this. I don't know if I'm going to want to read what it says and have these strategies in my head. And I was very cautious
about every social
about it.
Interaction.
I know. I thought I'm going to be analyzing anytime I meet a person on the street or talk to a friend. But I am reading the book, and one, it's written very well. It's conversational. It's based on Dale Carnegie, no relation to Andrew Carnegie. Dale Carnegie would give speeches, like seminars, about these same things, how to win friends, influence people, how to make people like you, how to win people to your way of thinking, not convince, but win people to your way of thinking. And the book came out of a publisher just said, well, we're going to have a stenographer sit in the audience and transcribe one of your speeches. And that's what they did. He read the transcript, thought, well, this is great. Let me add a few anecdotes, and we got a book. Wildly popular, wildly successful. It's been in print 80 years now. It is number 11 on Amazon's best-selling nonfiction books. So if you haven't read it yet, it's probably because you've avoided it at this point. But it's also like the first self-help book. There were no self-help books before this. There wasn't a genre before this. They didn't have a term for the genre before this book. They called it like an action book or something very strange like that back in the 30s and 40s because there was no label to put on this book. So anyway, how do you make people like you? I'm sure everyone's interested in that. And the advice is actually super simple and very easy. Smile. There's a whole chapter that encourages you to smile at people.
So was any of that information about smiling groundbreaking for you?
No.
Like, did you
absolutely not. Absolutely not. But it's presented in such a straightforward way and logical, careful argument for smiling that you feel like an idiot, that you've never thought of this before, and you haven't been doing this your whole life. How do you make people interested in you? And the book kind of comes out and says, no one's interested in you, just give up. What you want to do is be interested in them. And when you sit down and you're talking to someone, don't try to think of cool things about you. They don't want to hear about you. They're just waiting for their turn to talk. So go for it. Ask them questions. Let them talk. The book provides examples where at the end of conversations Dale Carnegie had with other people, he would just let them talk, ask them questions, and really sincere, like, tell me more. How does this work? You know, what are these facets of your job? And at the end of the conversation, they're like, well, that was very interesting evening. You're a very interesting person, Mr. Carnegie. And he's like, I didn't say anything about me. How am I interesting? But after that, it gets a little bit more subtle in terms of, you know, how to convince people to your way of thinking, how to convince people to do what you want them to do. And it's, again, it's nothing groundbreaking. It's nothing, you know, shattering. It's just simple things like present arguments in terms that they're going to respond to. Like, if you're applying for a job, don't talk about, I'm great, this is why I'm great, I went to this school, I did this, I did that. Talk about their company and what you think is great about their company and why you are applying to their company. Super simple, super obvious, and yet, why haven't I been doing this my entire life, is how I feel whenever I read a chapter out of this book.
Have you felt like you are better at persuasion and influencing people since reading this book?
No, I've been trying it, and it's hard. It's really hard to sit down and, you know, God bless my friends talking about their kids, and I'm not that interested, but I've been asking questions about their kids. Tell me more about how they did in math class. And so it's effective, but it's difficult because I'm thinking about what I want to talk about. I want to talk about when I was in math class and when I was a kid for no good reason. No one wants to hear that. So it is the simplest advice in the world, but it's effective and it's a fun read. The guy gave speeches his whole life and they just transcribed one of his speeches. That was the basis of the book. So it's very conversational. It's very lighthearted. It's very fun. The language is a little bit ancient. It's from the 30s. They updated it in the 80s to actually take out some examples that wouldn't make sense anymore and add some that would. Okay. So every little while a word pops in that you're like, they didn't have highlighters in the 30s. So I don't know. I love it. I'm halfway through it and I am buying in to how to win friends and influence people.
Does it seem more... Well, I'm just thinking, so it's from the 30s, and this is like the first self-help book, but obviously the genre has exploded since then.
Sure.
So with such simple advice, I'm wondering, how is it still relevant, or how is it still innovative compared to all these other self-help books that are so, you know, specific in their scope and supported by so much psychological evidence and things like that? So what accounts for the enduring popularity of it when there's so many other options right now?
I think part of the enduring popularity is the language, is that it's very friendly, very pleasant tone. It provides examples that are both personal and academic. Like, he'll provide examples of, I talked to my friend, and this is the conversation he has. And then he'll provide examples of, you know, Abraham Lincoln was revealed in this biography he read that had this habit of doing this or doing that. And so, like, you're always interested in these examples. You're always interested in these traits that great leaders had, and he brings them down and reduces them into how it can help you in your everyday life. And you start to wonder if great people really just have these aspects to them or found these aspects on their own or found them throughout their social endeavors, and that's how they got to be great, not some destiny that was born inside them that just led them down the path, but they paid attention when people talked and learned their friends' names. Because he makes the point that if you're trying to be a politician, that's going to be important. And these politicians, you know, demonstrate that in ways. They talk mm-hmm. about their tricks for remembering people's names and people's personal lives.
One of the things I heard a friend say was that there's like, maybe in the middle or at the end of a chapter, you know, he'll say, like, stop right now and do this thing, like, write down these things. Mm-hmm. Like, can you give an example of one that was particularly good? Because I also feel like that's something that the self-help genre definitely took. Now, action, now mm-hmm. do something.
He has instructions for how to read the book at the beginning. Like, I think it's 9 or 12 points. That while you read the book, you must do these things. And one of the rules is you have to read each chapter twice before going on to the next one. which is cute, but, you know, that's going to be effective, isn't it? If you kind of memorize what it is before, you're just like, I want to know the next thing and the next thing and the next thing. Mm-hmm. It's like you're not in the moment. You're not paying attention to the words on the page. You're too excited for the next chapter. So if you got to read it twice, you kind of zone in and be like, all right, I'm really going to pay attention this first time around because I don't want the second time around to be miserable, right? But he gives examples. There's some examples that were taken out in the move to the 80s version. Things like he gives a lot of advice as though you're a salesperson because that was a job that pretty much everyone was a salesperson or the brother of a salesperson or the son of a salesperson in the 30s. And so a lot of it is the next time you're on a sales call, do this. The next time you're at a new client, do that. And so that doesn't really apply so easily to me when I'm reading the book by myself. I'm not a salesperson. But he lays out very clear instructions. Next time you're on the phone, smile while you're talking to the person. Make yourself smile. They can't see you, but just do it. And then see if the conversation is any different. So that's How to Win Friends and Influence People by Dale Carnegie. It is certainly here at the library and pretty much anywhere these days on Amazon and on ebooks and anywhere you need to go. Last, we're all going to have a conversation about Black Mirror. I am going to confess at this point, usually all three of us participate on the final topic of the podcast, but Black Mirror, I have not been able to watch. I just can't do it. Something in me is not clicking. So I'm going to leave it up to the two of you to try and sell me on how, why should I finally watch Black Mirror? Why should anyone watch Black Mirror? So who wants to start?
Well, first, I'm curious because I thought you just didn't have time to watch the show, but now the truth comes out. We find out you are maybe antagonistic towards the show.
No, not to that effect, but I keep putting it off.
Okay, so it's not compelling you enough to...
And then I run out of time.
Yeah.
Right? So
it's one of those shows you like add to your queue, but never one you want to watch like right away.
Yes.
Okay.
That's right. I don't know. Maybe it was Daredevil came out and I was just, well, I could do work or I could watch Daredevil. Maybe something like that. But anyway, let's start with what is Black Mirror?
Do you want to take this or should I?
Sure, okay. I can go. So it's like an anthology type show. So where each episode is self-contained and each has its own cast and its own story. But they all have to do with a dystopian kind of near future. And each one has to do with the dark side of technology in some way. So it's kind of like each episode is kind of like a darkly comic kind of show that's been characterized as kind of like Twilight Zone-y in some ways. But they each have their own story and their own plot. And there's a lot of cynicism and a lot of satire. I think the best way probably is to just describe a storyline for it. Mm-hmm. Do you want to talk about what one of them would be?
I think one of my favorite ones, 15 Million Merits. It's about, this one is a little bit more dystopian than the others. I think a lot of these other ones are like very similar to our reality. This one is like, this person is very much in a self-contained, almost like world where it's him pedaling on a bike to gain points. And then based on what ads he allows himself to watch and things and like, whether it's ads or like racy videos or like pornography, like he'll actually get points for that for some reason. And he doesn't know the logic behind it other than the fact that you can buy your way into a reality TV show kind of thing. And it's really, I think it's probably the most cynical view of like reality TV and just like literally being in a hamster wheel kind of thing and like trying to like find people within that mess of like media and money and like boiling all of society down to like media and money and there's very little other stimulation in that entire world. Like everybody's just a zombie kind of walking through this very sterile environment. So that one I thought was just really, really cool because it did take it, it turned the level of like sci-fi and dystopian way up. Mm-hmm. Whereas another one, and I don't want to spoil anything too much for you. So
no, that's all right. Don't worry about me.
But I mean, yeah, because you may not. But whereas another one might be something that is a little bit more of a reality we could understand. Like maybe everybody has visual implants in their eyes that go to their brain, and you can actually record all of your interactions so that you can rewind it and go back to a specific interaction. Like the other day when you said you were going to watch... No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, sure.
Or like if you went to an interview, and this is the example he uses, he's like rewatching his interview and scrutinizing himself and being like, oh, I shouldn't have said it that way.
Yeah, so it's not like it's a super far away future, but it's a future like maybe 10 minutes from now, you know, where we're interacting with this technology. And also with the technology are like neuroses. A lot of it has to do with like our fear and anxiety and how technology affects those things.
Sure, because this concept sounds evocative of YouTube and Facebook, where every part of our lives almost is being recorded. Not actually, but it's getting kind of close. So it sounds like good satire, where it takes a premise and blows it all the way out and goes all the way to what is the absolute extreme example of this sort of behavior or this sort of situation.
I think that the only thing that I would worry about using the word satire or like labeling it that totally is that I feel like there's definitely like a strong beating heart at the center of the show with the dynamics of the characters, which is not to say that satire can't have that necessarily, but the emotions I think are the backbone or the character dynamics of the relationships of people and how they are affected by these situations. So, for example, in one story, a woman's boyfriend dies, and she's grieving, so her friend signs her up for this beta program where it scans all of her boyfriend's internet usage, so his profiles, his social media, all his emails and everything, and then creates this kind of AI version of him where at first just she receives emails from this AI version of him using his words cobbled together, and then it calls her because they pull his voice from videos that he had. And then at the end, it's like, oh, this company can now create this simulated flesh version of your boyfriend who looks exactly like your boyfriend, but, you know, isn't. And the dynamics of that, but even though it has this premise that's, you know, out there in very typical science fiction, her grief and kind of her despair and how that affects the choices that she makes through it are really what drive the story forward, I think.
Sure. Yeah, and that one was called Be Right Back. It was a very intense because a very up-and-coming then actor, Domhnall Gleeson, was in it.
Oh, sure.
He's now is like...
Star Wars.
Pretty large. Yeah, Star Wars, and we talked about him. And but yeah, I don't know. I like that one stuck out a lot to me too because you're kind of with her along every step of the decision-making. And it's not like a given that she's really going to create this. You don't really know exactly what she's getting into. Like, she doesn't really know what she's getting into. And it's kind of a discovery in that one of kind of the limits of technology. And I think one of the great things about Black Mirror is it shows you some of the repercussions, but it doesn't really spell them out. It kind of keeps it all in the theoretical kind of, you see the results of some of these things play out, but we don't really know whether or not it would ever get to some of these points.
It keeps a lot of nuance in it, or the areas are black and white where we don't see like the full extent of like whether this is this technology is like destroying people or if it's actually like helping them in certain ways and stuff. So
And I think that's what it was. It seemed like a very healing effect on her, and that's part of the hard thing about watching that. Like, it was healing her for a period, or it was keeping her from that grief.
Exactly. But then at the end, like, these don't have happy endings, you know. They're definitely very dark. But one thing I thought was interesting was that the creator said that the title Black Mirror comes from the black mirror of our screen. So like our phone screen, our TV screen, those are all the black mirrors. And again, I think it's kind of like reflecting the anxieties we have. But it's not just a send up of like the millennial Twitter generation. I think it's the speculative nature of the stories are really inventive, I think.
And that's why I'm excited that Netflix is re-upping it for like, I think, several more shows or something like that. Because it's like maybe now that the public is more educated about how all this technology is influencing us or is like invading our lives, you know, what they could choose. They have so much to work with now, I think even more so.
Yeah. Bryce Dallas Howard is going to be in one of the new ones. So it seems like they have some interesting people that are going to be on board for Netflix. Yeah. How else can we convince you? What questions do you have?
Well, so that was a surprise on its own, is that I knew it was similar to The Twilight Zone. And so I thought it would be just about the premises. And the way you're describing the emotional pull of these episodes is something I did not expect at all.
Yeah, and if I can go back, even that one about the 15 million credits, it was about a relationship that formed within that bubble. It wasn't necessarily about just the consequences of such a society or something like that. It was about human relationship and how that played it to a head.
So, that's interesting. Yeah. That is not something I expected from reading the synopses and the reviews online.
Yeah, and I think that it's admirable because it's hard to create, you know, a character that you feel like you can identify with in some way, especially when each episode has different characters, like that we can't, like, we don't have a greater arc over the series, because each one, there's like a central kind of relationship in each episode, that they can have the premise or the science in it. That's not like the central focus, but that the relationship and the premise kind of work together where each one depends on the other one to make it make sense.
Sure.
That's why I was drawn into it.
All right. Well, I don't know. With the responsibility off me, maybe I'll watch it. Maybe I won't. But you've definitely moved me one step closer to watching Black Mirror. It's on Netflix. I think it's like season one is out on DVD.
Possibly. I was looking for it. I don't know where.
But Netflix is the place to go for sure if you want to watch Black Mirror.
And the season three is coming out soon.
So. Excellent. Okay. Well, thank you, Tony. Thank you, Jamie. And that is the Pint and Click podcast for the day. Thank you.
Thank you.